From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I am advising pregnant women and preschool-age children to leave the area within a five-mile radius of the Three Mile Island facility until further notice.
25 years after the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history, we take a look back at Three Mile Island. All eyes were on Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, as the nation and world awaited a full-scale meltdown. We speak to the reporter who won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on the disaster. Then Rwanda, on the 10th anniversary of the genocide that killed over 800,000 people, we look at the U.S. role and how the Clinton administration worked to ensure there was no international intervention until it was too late. But first, we go to Iraq, where nine U.S. military and contractors were killed yesterday, four of them in Fallujah, dragged through the streets and hung over the Euphrates in scenes reminiscent of Somalia. We'll talk about the firm they worked for, Blackwater. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the second day in a row, a U.S. military convoy has come under attack near Fallujah. It's not yet clear if there are any casualties. On Wednesday, four U.S. contractors were murdered and then mutilated in the Iraqi city of Fallujah in one of the most graphic attacks on U.S. interests since the invasion of Iraq. Nearby, five U.S. soldiers were killed in a separate attack. In the attack on the contractors, news agencies captured photos and images of their burnt corpses being dismembered in the streets. Two of the bodies were tied up under a bridge and lynched over the Euphrates. The others were dragged through the streets behind cars and hacked to pieces. The New York Times reports seeing a 10-year-old boy stepping on a burnt head screaming, "Where is Bush? Let him come here and see this." The incident came on the same day the total number of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq reached 600. The four Americans killed on Wednesday all worked for the firm Blackwater, which routinely hires former soldiers, often ex-Navy SEALs, to form essentially a private army that largely exists outside the public eye. It's unknown how many private U.S. contractors have been killed, though it's been reported the Army is relying on private security companies more as the opposition to the occupation intensifies. There appears to have been no U.S. effort to save the contractors or even to collect the bodies until hours after the attack. On Wednesday, the Coalition Provisional Authority's website didn't even mention the attacks. One of the top headlines on the website read, quote, "Iraqi police equal to task of public safety." Middle East analyst Juan Cole says the degree of hatred among ordinary Iraqis towards Americans is bad news for the occupying forces. He writes, quote, "It helps explain why so few of the Sunni Arab guerrillas have been caught since the locals hide and help them. It also seems a little unlikely that further U.S. military action can do anything practical to put down this insurgency," he writes. "Most action it could take would simply inflame the public against them all the more. It seems likely to me the guerrilla violence will continue for years," Juan Cole writes. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is now admitting it's carried out 18,000 evacuations from Iraq for medical reasons over the past year. The total includes evacuation for emergency and non-emergency situations. The Washington Post is reporting National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice is scheduled to give a foreign major policy address on September 11, 2001, calling for missile defense to be the centerpiece of defense strategy. The speech, of course, was canceled. It's making news now because of what she was scheduled to say or more specifically, not say. According to U.S. officials who saw the text of her speech, Al-Qaeda was never mentioned as a possible threat. Osama bin Laden was not mentioned either. Instead, Dr. Rice was set to argue missile defense was needed to combat, quote, the threats and problems of today and the day after, not the world of yesterday. The Washington Post reports, quote, the speech provides telling insight into the administration's thinking on the very day the United States suffered the most devastating attack since the 1941 bombing of Pearl Harbor. The speech appears to explicitly support the charge of the Bush administration's former counterterrorism chief, Richard Clark, that Bush and Rice were not focused on the danger of terrorism in the lead-up to 9/11. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting President Bush's top lawyer placed a telephone call to at least one of the Republican members of the September 11th commission before it heard testimony from Clark. The commissioner identified was Fred Fielding. California Congressmember Henry Waxman said any such contact would be inappropriate because, quote, the conduct of the White House is one of the key issues being investigated by the commission. In campaign news, the Washington Post reporting the Bush campaign and the Republican Party filed charges yesterday with the Federal Election Commission accusing the Kerry campaign and seven independent organizations of conducting a criminal conspiracy to inject large amounts of soft money into the 2004 election. The complaint accuses groups such as Move On and Media Fund of illegally running ads criticizing President Bush. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you, our listeners, viewers, and those who are getting us streamed on the internet.
We're going to start in Iraq today. For the second day in a row, U.S. military convoy has come under attack near Fallujah. Today, it's not clear or if there are any casualties. But on Wednesday, four U.S. contractors were murdered, then mutilated in the Iraqi city of Fallujah in one of the most graphic attacks on U.S. interests since the invasion of Iraq. Nearby, five U.S. soldiers were killed in a separate attack. The pictures are now becoming well-known, news agencies capturing the photos and images of burnt corpses being dismembered in the streets, two bodies tied up under a bridge and lynched over the Euphrates, others dragged through the streets behind cars hacked to pieces. Four Americans killed on Wednesday all worked for the firm Blackwater, which routinely hires former soldiers, often ex-Navy SEALs, to form essentially a private army that largely exists outside the private eye. Today, we turn to Ghassan al-Mukhtar. He is a retired Iraqi engineer in Baghdad right now, recently in Fallujah. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ghassan.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe the reaction in the streets to what took place in Fallujah?
This sad incident happened in Fallujah, where 2 days before that, the American army shot many, many people, women and children, on the street in a bizarre shooting incident that is unjustified, killing many people. Fallujah has been a place where the U.S. Army has actually used brutal force to suppress the people, including using the F-15s and F-16s to attack villages and attack places where they think is the resistance are, which is unjustified to use a high explosive against an individual. This resulted in many, many casualties in the province. Added to it, they have detained for 50 or 60 days hundreds of people on and off, which alienated the people against the American forces and the American contractors or the American security contractors, which are really a private army uncontrollable by the U.S. This is a part of the privatization of the war. 2 days ago, 3 days ago, there was a similar incident in Mosul where two contractors were killed on the electricity. They were going to the electricity generating plant. The important, the thing that I noticed that the media says those contractors were involved in protecting the food supply. It's really food supply for the U.S. Army, not to be confused with providing help to the local population or anything. It's just a routine U.S. convoy. It may have food, may on other occasions be armament or anything. So the resentment of the people of Fallujah are justified. What happened to them is it's a sad thing, but you know, brutality breeds brutality, and violence breeds violence. And he who started first takes the responsibility. And I think the U.S. Army have used unjustified force against the people of Fallujah, and they have brutalized the people of Fallujah to the point where they had to respond with the same brutality.
Well, some of the commercial media here in the United States are claiming that Fallujah is a hotbed of resistance, that up to 70% of the people are supporting attacks or have voiced in opinion poll supports for attacks on the U.S. forces. Is there a continuing large presence of U.S. military within this within the city itself, or have they largely pulled out to the outskirts of Fallujah?
They pulled out of the outskirts, but they keep intruding into the city. The other day, 10 days ago, I was passing through Fallujah, and right in the middle of the city, they blocked the main highway, and we saw inside the city a large convoy of U.S. Military vehicles. So they keep coming in and out. If they keep out, I don't think they will have that many attacks on them. But don't forget, those are an occupying force, and it is the people believe that they have the right to resist an occupying force, a foreign occupying force. The closest we come to you is 8 hours difference. That's 8,000, 9,000 miles between us. So you people have came to the east 8,000 miles to run a country you have no business in occupying.
Ghassan al-Mukhtar.
After we discovered that there was no justification for the U.S. occupation whatsoever, because there is no weapon of mass destruction, weapon of mass deception that has been propagated by the U.S. administration.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Ghassan al-Mukhtar, retired Iraqi engineer, speaking to us from Baghdad. Later in the program, we'll focus specifically on the firm Blackwater, where the four U.S. Contractors were from, who were killed in Fallujah. Thank you for being with us. As we turn now to Three Mile Island, Juan?
Well, it was the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history. 25 years ago this week, the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor at Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, malfunctioned, sparking a near meltdown, that resulted in the release of radioactivity in the pre-dawn hours of March 28, 1979. The cooling system of the Three Mile Islands Unit 2 reactor malfunctioned, causing temperatures inside to skyrocket. Early that morning, pumps feeding cooling water to the plant's reactor failed, and 32,000 gallons of radioactive superheated water spewed from a faulty valve into the doomed concrete reactor housing. Without water to cool them, more than half of the reactor's 36,000 nuclear rods ruptured.
Lieutenant Governor William Scranton appeared on local television, warned residents to close their doors and windows, urged them to stay inside. Harrisburg Mayor Stephen Reed said the message to lock windows and stay indoors was akin to telling everyone to evacuate. Some estimate well over 100,000 people fled Harrisburg and the surrounding areas.
The accident at Three Mile Island will eventually fuel the nuclear debate in this country that rages to this day. In a moment, we'll be joined by Susan Stranahan, the lead reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer's Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the Three Mile Island disaster. But first, we turn to an excerpt from the documentary Containment, Life After Three Mile Island. It was produced by Nick Poppe and Charles Bubble.
This reminder that the Harrisburg Area Chapter of the American Red Cross needs... Okay, we have this news bulletin that we're going to get on right now. Here's Mike Pintek.
Okay, thank you, Jim. What has happened is that there has been an uncontrolled release of radiation from the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant. State officials have put local civil defense agencies on alert.
This morning between 7:30 and probably quarter after 8, we did have to vent one of our tanks that contained radioactive gas. Yes, the situation is under control. And yes, we know what we're doing. I don't know why we need to tell you each and everything that we do, specifically when we make...
Attention, please. There has been a state of emergency declared on Three Mile Island.
Please remain indoors, doors shut, windows shut, fans not operating, until you hear word that it is safe to go outside.
Governor Thornburgh could get no guarantee that there would not be more unplanned releases of radiation.
And Friday morning was when the governor issued his precautionary evacuation notice.
I am advising pregnant women and preschool-age children to leave the area within a 5-mile radius of the Three Mile Island facility until further notice.
An excerpt of the documentary Containment, Life After Three Mile Island, produced by Nick Poppe and Chris Bobel. We turn now to the reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer who led the Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the Three Mile Island accident. She now writes regularly on nuclear issues for Mother Jones. Take us back to that day. Susan Stranahan.
Well, listening to the excerpts brought back a lot of memories. I've been rereading coverage, both the stuff that dated 25 years ago and coverage about the 25th anniversary of the accident. And all of the stories contain a lot of details. None of them contain quite the level of uncertainty and confusion and fear that pervaded. I think you got a sense of that from the excerpt from the documentary, but it was a very frightening time. I compared it in a piece that I wrote for the anniversary to the 9/11 catastrophe. Certainly was not in any magnitude close to the tragedy of September the 11th, but at least that was up until the 9/11 accident. Certainly, probably the most frightening time that many Americans had experienced, at least those in this part of the country.
Well, Susan, I remember being a cub reporter that year at the Philadelphia Daily News, so I wasn't chosen by my editors to go to Three Mile Island. But can you talk a little bit about the changes that the reporters went through, who were assigned like yourself to cover the accident, and what emotional changes went through you at deciding? Because I know there were some at the Philadelphia Daily News who refused to go, who said they didn't want to take a chance.
I think there were 39 reporters from the Inquirer that covered the story, most of them out there, and it was one of the great conflicts that journalists have, whether they're covering a disaster, a war, a fire, whatever. Half of you, your heart and your gut want you there because you know it's the most amazing story, and your brain is telling you any rational person probably would not be here. The drama and the significance of the moment, I think, kept a lot of people working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just to see how this whole thing would play out.
We're talking to Susan Stranahan, who led the Pulitzer Prize-winning Philadelphia Inquirer coverage of the Three Mile Island accident 25 years ago. We'll continue with her in just a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on more than 220 Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on direct Dish Network, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, satellite television, and the largest public media collaboration in this country. And if you want to get us on your TV or radio station, you can just call or go to our website and find out how at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. In just a few minutes, we'll be talking about the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan massacre, the Rwandan genocide. We're also going to be talking about the firm that the U.S. Civilians now in Fallujah came from, who were killed. But right now, we're talking about the 25th anniversary of Three Mile Island, how it was covered, and some comparisons to how 911 was covered. Susan Stranahan is with us, won the Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on Three Mile Island. What about the coverage and how it was managed and the role of one of the largest PR firms in the world, Hill & Knowlton?
I had no contact with Hill & Knowlton, and I, Amy, I'm not sure what you were referring to there. The problem that we had as reporters was fairly complex. One, we're not nuclear engineers, so we were working with that handicap. We were also working with bureaucracies and experts that clearly didn't have a clue what was going on. We were working with the utility company that just would never tell the truth, would stand up and absolutely just lie day after day, hour after hour. And there was an excerpt of that from the documentary. So we were basically thrown into a situation where you are doing basic reporting on an incredibly complicated problem, and that's where good journalistic instincts come into play. And it was digging and asking questions and being skeptical and going to as many people as you could possibly think of. And I remember we used everybody from nuclear physicists and PhDs down to high school science teachers that we would call up and say, basically, quick, give us a crash course in X, Y, and Z. And everyone worked together. There were some mistakes, as there always are when you're under that enormous amount of pressure. But I think in reading back the stories, given the limitations of time, given the amount of information that just was not there and would not become available for years, the stories hold up quite well, both from a technical standpoint, as well as to just the total breakdown of the regulatory system in this country and in a corporate mentality of just no hesitancy to just lie through their teeth.
Yeah, on that question, obviously there were several groups that should have been exercised responsibility. There was the owners of Three Mile Island themselves. There were the public officials and then the local public officials. And then there was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. What was looking back on it, your assessment of how each of these groups functioned? You've told us a little bit about the Three Mile Island owners. What about the public officials and the NRC?
Well, the NRC has always labored under a cloud of being a promoter of nuclear power rather than a regulator, and in this instance, by and large, they fell back onto a rather defensive posture of not being as candid as they could have been in terms of the potential risk. But I think the bottom line on that one is that they didn't know either. They didn't know what was going on. They had worked under this mindset that something like this could not happen, therefore it wasn't happening, yet it was. So for hours and the early days, they were as confused as those of us were in the newsroom because this wasn't supposed to happen. There were two heroes in this, many heroes in this, but the two most prominent heroes were Governor Dick Thornburg, who remained calm and became a figure that the public trusted. And he was a guy who was just pulling out his hair because he couldn't get any answers, and he felt responsibility for the health and safety of hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvanians. And the other hero was Harold Denton, who was eventually sent up from the NRC on the orders of President Jimmy Carter, who was equally as upset and frustrated by his government's inability to give a clear and straight answer to a very panicked public. Once both of those people, especially Harold Denton, were on the scene, at least there became a single voice speaking and a voice that people, including the members of the media, began to at least feel that they were getting a straight story. So it was a breakdown. It was a breakdown of the bureaucracies, but there were two people that stepped to the plate and said, "We will begin to try and do our jobs here and calm a panicked public."
Susan Stranahan, can you talk about the comparison of coverage between Three Mile Island 1979, 25 years ago, and then what happened on September 11th?
I wasn't anywhere close to the September 11th sites, either here in Pennsylvania or in Washington or in New York, and didn't have any direct role in it. So I can't speak firsthand on that. Obviously, there were terrible differences between them. There were no loss of life in Three Mile Island, in the Three Mile Island accident, the catastrophes of 9/11. The fact that this played out in front of the eyes of America was amazing. It was a terrorist attack. It wasn't the failure of a piece of machinery, which was frightening in and of itself. This was a terrorist attack on America. So psychologically, it was much, much different. I think the coverage was fantastic. It offered many of the same challenges to the media, because like a melting down reactor, nobody in the media ever thought in their right mind they'd walk to work one morning and be the next hour be out there covering a terrorist attack in downtown Manhattan with people leaping from buildings and planes crashing into the. I mean, it was just. It's one of those things that as a reporter, you get up in the morning and you always say, well, I don't know what's going to happen before the time I come home. And there's always a likelihood, you know, God forbid, that this is the sort of thing you're going to be doing. So people jump in, they use their best skills, they know that their first obligation is to get the information out to the public, and they put themselves at risk in doing it, and I think that's the comparison.
So also, since you've continued to write now on nuclear issues for Mother Jones, and I'm wondering about your reaction hearing this week that a group of private companies wants to build the first nuclear power plant since obviously none has been built in this country since Three Mile Island. And your thoughts, having dealt with the issue, again, as Americans try to grapple with the question of the future of nuclear energy?
Well, I think that I'm not surprised. You look at the forces that are at work here. You've got energy prices soaring. You've got pressure to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You've got clean air concerns. You've got a very friendly administration in the White House that is very pro-nuclear. I mean, the Cheney Energy Plan that was put forth was called for building 1,000 new nuclear plants by 2020, which averages something like one a week. That's not going to happen. But I'm not surprised. I would think if there are a group of investors that wanted to put up the capital to do it, then it probably will go forward. My concerns are that none of the issues that existed in 1979 with nuclear power have been resolved. We still don't know what to do with the waste it produces. We still don't have a technology that we can trust 100%. I mean, the line I always use is that the ultimate safety plan for a nuclear reactor is a mass evacuation. And despite assurances that the plants are safer and the utility companies are better run, I'm not sure I buy into that. There's an awful lot of pressure to cut costs in utility companies now with energy deregulation. The NRC is turning over more and more of the regular authority of, you know, the safety inspections to the companies themselves, and the reactors that we have in this country are getting near the end of their useful lives, and the NRC has indicated a willingness to extend the operating licenses another 20 years, which is, you know, they were meant to last for 40 years, so we're extending them for another 20, at the same time that there are economic pressures that keep the utilities from probably making as many major repairs as the public might like to have them do. So I'm not surprised that there's someone out there that's going to propose it. I would be very interested if ultimately it succeeds.
Susan Stranahan, I want to thank you very much for being with us, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on Three Mile Island disaster 25 years ago, was reporting for the Philadelphia Inquirer, now covers nuclear issues for Mother Jones. You are listening to Democracy Now! And democracynow.org as we turn to the anniversary of Rwanda.
Well, this month marks the 10th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. 10 years ago, on April 6th, 1994, Rwanda's extremist Hutu government and military led a campaign to exterminate the nation's minority Tutsis. An estimated 800,000 people were killed in 3 months of tribal bloodletting. Men, women, and children were slaughtered in an orchestrated, pre-planned campaign of genocide not seen since the Jewish Holocaust. The killing continued for 100 days, and in Rwanda, the machete became the symbol of horror.
One much-practiced strategy was to drive Tutsis into centers such as churches and schools and then kill them en masse. Stories abound of Tutsis being disabled by having a leg chopped off and left on the ground to await the return of their killers. Tutsis pleading to be put out of their mercy quickly, children being slaughtered in front of their parents, women being gang raped, subjected to unspeakable acts before being killed. The world claimed it was unaware of the magnitude of the slaughter. The United Nations peacekeeping force stationed in the country stood by helplessly and watched the massacre unfold.
On a visit to the Rwandan capital, Kigali, in 1998, President Clinton apologized for not acting quickly enough or immediately calling the crimes genocide. He said, quote, "It may seem strange to you here, especially the many of you who lost members of your family, but all over the world there were people like me sitting in offices day after day after day who did not fully appreciate the depth and speed with which you were being engulfed by this unimaginable terror."
But the international community and the U.S. in particular are not just guilty of apathy. They had actively worked to ensure there was no international intervention until it was too late. We're going to look at some of the latest documents that the National Security Archive have obtained, classified U.S. intelligence reports that concluded as early as April 23, 94, the slaughter in Rwanda amounted to a genocide. But first, we turn to Stephen Lewis, who is the former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what the West knew and when they knew it?
I can try, Amy. I think all of the efforts, disgraceful efforts, to distance oneself from and the West from what happened and what they knew, even as late as 10 years later, has to come to an end. The West knew. We all knew within days of the genocide beginning on April 7, 1994. That we were witnessing in Rwanda something that was unprecedented in the annals of human behavior since the Holocaust in Nazi Germany and Europe, and the reports that were coming back from the various diplomatic missions and a few of the journalists who were on the ground, and people like General Romeo Dallaire, who headed the UN peacekeeping troops and was actually a Canadian as it happens, all of the information prior to the genocide breaking out, particularly in the fateful months of January to April of 1994, it was all being documented and tabulated, and everyone knew what was coming and when it started, what was happening. This disavowal is enough to make you weep, and it was absolutely classic, the lack of intervention, and it flowed in significant measure from the American prior involvement in Somalia. But it also flowed from an international community that just wrote Rwanda off in an act of extraordinary racism.
You were appointed by the Organization of African Unity to head a panel of eminent personalities to investigate the genocide. Could you tell us from your perspective why? Why did they wait so long and allow this to happen?
Sure. Just a footnote. I was a member of the panel. I did not head it. There were many complicating factors. I think that in part no one cared about Rwanda. Rwanda didn't count in the geopolitical flow of things. Post-Cold War, who cared about a little country in Africa? That was a continuing reality, not much acknowledged, but always in the background. Number two, the American experience in Somalia when the Marines were killed in 1993 put the United States into absolute reverse when it came to engaging in any international conflict by way of peacekeeping or peacemaking or bringing the peace. The United States was completely gun-shy, wanted no part of it, and was prepared to undermine the workings of the Security Council in order to avoid it. I mean, one of the things which was very difficult for people like myself, I'm a democratic socialist. I'm a Canadian who is an open and public left-winger. I've always had a natural feeling for the Democratic Party in the United States if one makes the choice. Well, one of the things which astonished all of us was the way in which Madeleine Albright in the Security Council was the person who put up one of the strongest fights against anything, any response. And of course, she received her marching orders from William Jefferson Clinton. I've always found that hard intellectually to understand and to rationalize. In addition to that, the French and the Belgians and the Catholic Church and numbers of other countries in the background just wanted no part of what they thought was a fratricidal inter-ethnic rivalry. They were prepared to see it play out, and the African countries surrounding Rwanda, alas, were themselves detached because nobody was prepared to intervene. They didn't have the resources, and they didn't have the instincts.
We're talking to Stephen Lewis, who in 1997 was appointed by the Organization of African Unity to a panel of eminent personalities to investigate the genocide in Rwanda. The Rwanda report was issued in June 2000. It charged the United States, France, Belgium, as well as the Catholic and Anglican churches actively prevented peacekeepers from moving in to stop the genocide in Rwanda. When we come back, we'll also be joined by a fellow at the National Security Archive who has just obtained classified U.S. intelligence reports that talk about what the U.S. knew and when they knew it. And we'll also look at the role of Richard Clark in the White House and what he understood about Rwanda. Stay with us. Rinaldo Inagho, Title Experiment 1. This is Democracy Now! And democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we talk on this 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, where over 800,000 Rwandans were killed. We're talking to Stephen Lewis, who investigated the genocide for the Organization of African Unity, part of a panel of eminent personalities to investigate the genocide in Rwanda, and William Ferrajaro, who is a consulting fellow at National Security Archive, which recently obtained classified U.S. intelligence reports that concluded as early as April 23rd, 1994, the slaughter in Rwanda amounted to a genocide. Also a consultant on a new PBS Frontline documentary called Ghosts of Rwanda, which is premiering tonight. William Ferrajaro, can you outline the documents that you have gotten recently declassified?
Yes, Amy, and thank you for calling them declassified, because I obtained them under the Freedom of Information Act, and the agencies declassified them. And so just a short plug for the efficacy of freedom of information. The documents themselves, I think, are important really in two ways. I've wrote a report, and there's 53 documents on the website of the National Security Archive, which for your listeners is www.nsarchive.org. And I invite everyone to visit the website. I think the importance of the material is this. First, it shows the vast array of information and intelligence inputs available to senior policymakers. In other words, they had the capability to know, and they did know. Some of the information that I've published up there, that you mentioned, the April 23rd report, was in the National Intelligence Daily, which goes under another name now, but back then was distributed to the top several hundred policymakers within the U.S. government, and that was Rwanda was an item in there, in very graphic terms, almost daily from the onset of the crisis through the U.S. Humanitarian relief operations in July. I guess the second main point about the material is that this is the first pieces of official evidence of senior leadership knowing and, in fact, meeting on Rwanda. We're still trying to find out just exactly how many meetings there were of Clinton's Principals Committee, which would be his National Security Council, minus his involvement and the Vice President's involvement. But there were numerous meetings of the Deputies Committee, which is the number two or three officials at each agency meeting at the White House, and they were specifically tasked for crisis management. And Rwanda was on their agenda numerous times. So it's really, I think, the importance of this information shows that these individuals were not out of the loop on Rwanda. In fact, met on it. The fact that they decided not to do anything owes to other interests and other perspectives, but it's not a question of not knowing.
Could you talk a little bit about Richard Clark and his role during those crucial months?
Sure.
And what he advised
Clark,
or didn't?
Mr. Clark, it was a senior staff person in the National Security Council and headed the controversial peacekeeping review policy, which was promulgated as Presidential Decision Directive 25 in May of 1994, right at the height of the genocide. But it was under review from March of 1993. Clark, as we witness now on the terrorism debate, was a very able and effective and hard-nosed bureaucratic insider and coordinated the review of this policy. But what I would say is that he came up with a structure, and I think the intent of the structure was, in fact, had some positive motivations. It was to say that the UN had, at that point in early 93, 94, had already embarked on 18 peacekeeping missions worldwide. There just weren't the resources for it. And the U.S. was still stuck, as Ambassador Lewis said, in a, like the, much of the rest of the world, in a Cold War mindset, and was not about to undertake all additional operations. There just was not enough resources to go around if you're paying attention to the Koreas, the Bosnias, Russia, Haiti, for example. So I think what happens here is Clark leads this review and is very effective and brings this policy forward. The president signs it, it's promulgated, but by no means he coordinated the policy. It was not his instigation. And he served additionally on a structure under the National Security Council called the Peacekeeping Core Group, which was comprised of mid-level officials involved with peacekeeping. And so it was his brief on the National Security Council as a senior staff member. But even to his credit, I think Mr. Clark, who said in Samantha Power's article, you know, that he's not embarrassed about his role, one of the documents I published from April 29th, where he's in preparation for a deputies committee meeting, one of his papers going up to the representatives for that meeting says, the deputy should provide direction to the interagency working group on the degree of activism that they wish to encourage on further international steps aimed at addressing the slaughter and assisting refugees. In other words, the senior officials did not want to intervene, but even officials such as Mr. Clark needed direction and had to go back because the information they were getting from below was so horrific that they wanted clarification on the guidance and just how active they needed to be.
We're talking to William Ferrajaro, consulting fellow at the National Security Archive, obtained the declassified U.S. intelligence reports on Rwanda. Can you talk about the significance of using the term genocide? If the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Madeleine Albright, or President Clinton, or any of a number of U.S. officials had used that term, how it would have triggered international action, and so while privately using the term, would not publicly use it?
I think what's interesting is my research has indicated that, as Ambassador Lewis said, and you said at the outset, that within a week, 10 days, people had a real good idea that this was something of a completely different nature. So the question of using the term, I tend to think, and others as well, that this might not have – the Genocide Convention of 1948, approved or ratified by the U.S. Senate in 1988 – says that obligates signatories to prevent and punish genocide. Now, does that mean setting up a force to go in to places like Rwanda and stopping the genocide, I don't think the U.S. or other countries would have interpreted it that way. What it would have done was created, rather than a legal obligation, a political obligation. And so I think the use of secrecy here and the use of the restriction of discussing this in these terms meant that there was no political impetus from the public that would pressure Clinton into doing anything. And as Samantha Power notes in her book, no president has ever suffered from not intervening to stop genocide. So it's really a question of raising a public pressure. And, you know, we have to look back. The U.S. public was divided on Bosnia at that point. And as Ambassador Lewis mentioned at the outset, Somalia cast a huge pall over Washington, particularly with regard to peacekeeping. And I think the White House, particularly Anthony Lake and the National Security Council, were very involved in the Somalia operations in the Somalia engagement, and so we're particularly burned by that, and that really sealed the deal after acknowledging that the Cold War mindset and the traditional interests in geopolitics still reigned within the Clinton administration.
And finally, I'd like to ask Stephen Lewis, former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations, a final word on this whole issue of reconciliation, that there are many of those who committed these atrocities who are now being let out of jail in Rwanda, and how does a nation reach some kind of reconciliation over such a horrible past?
Let me first say that I both agree with and am fascinated by all that has just been said by your other guest, because I think it so completely corresponds with what everyone thought and assumed and intuited at the time, and yet no one would acknowledge. And it's a sad commentary on human affairs that even now people pretend that they didn't know, that was the fundamental problem. It wasn't a problem of policy. It was a problem of knowledge. It was like the old business that no one knew what those trains were, where those trains were going as they rumbled down the tracks to Auschwitz in 1944. It's really sad the way human behavior repeats itself. In terms of reconciliation, Rwanda is making actually a superhuman internal effort. It's really fascinating because it's only 10 years. Blood is still on the soil and on the hands of the killers. And yet within the country, you have to acknowledge Kagame's tremendous efforts using human rights commissions and truth and reconciliation commissions, using peace education in the schools, moving heaven and earth to try to overcome the sense of fratricidal polarity in the country. And, you know, they're making real progress. It's stunning. And because a lot of the laws being dispensed at the grassroots through a legal system called Gacaca, it is having some effect because it penetrates right down to community level. They may make it. Against all odds, they may make it.
Well, we will continue to cover this story next week on this 10th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda that saw up to 1 million Rwandans killed. I want to thank you both for being with us, Stephen Lewis, former Canadian ambassador to the UN, as well as William Ferjero, consulting fellow at the National Security Archive. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we wrap up with our top story today. Juan?
Yes, well, on Wednesday, four American contractors were brutally killed in Fallujah. Their bodies were beaten, dragged through the streets, and mutilated. Two of the corpses were hung from a bridge over the Euphrates River. It marked the most gruesome attack on U.S. interests captured on film since the start of the U.S. invasion. The four Americans who were killed worked for a private security firm called Blackwater USA. Blackwater is one of the growing number of for-profit companies hired by the U.S. military to do work traditionally performed by soldiers. It was founded in 1997 by an ex-Navy SEAL.
In August of last year, Blackwater was awarded a $21 million no-bid contract to supply security guards and two helicopters for Paul Bremer, the head of the U.S. occupation in Iraq. The company also provides security for food shipments in the Fallujah area. According to Knight Ritter, at least 33 U.S. civilian contractors have been killed in Iraq, but the total could be much higher because the deaths of contractors often receive far less attention than the deaths of soldiers. On Wednesday, the Coalition Provisional Authority's website didn't even mention the attacks. One of the top headlines on the website read, quote, "Iraqi police equal to task of public safety." We're joined now by investigative reporter Barry Yeoman. Last year, he wrote a major article for Mother Jones on these private security firms titled Soldier of Good Fortune. He joins us on the phone now. In these brief few minutes we have, Barry, can you talk about Blackwater and the men now in Fallujah from Blackwater, USA?
Sure. Blackwater is a small player in a very big field. We have seen tenfold growth in private military firms since 1991, when we were in the first Gulf War. And we typically hear about Halliburton and DynCorp. They're really big players. However, Blackwater is a small company that has very big dreams. It was founded by a group of Navy SEALs, and it's headed by a former Navy SEAL who told me his goal was to build the largest private army in the world. He has talked about expanding to serve militaries in France, in other places, and right now has contracts that he says are so secret that he's not able to tell one branch of the feds that he's working for a different branch of the feds. They provide all sorts of military services, as you know, with no bid contracts sometimes, and they stop short of combat, but it's often hard to see the line between what's combat and what's not combat.
Also, you write that quite a few of the people who work for Blackwater are Chileans who were from the time of Pinochet in Chile.
Not my article, no.
Oh, it wasn't your article. I'm sorry.
Although there are some references to it now that Blackwater USA has employed some Chilean Pinochet, some of ex-Pinochet forces.
I suspect that there is a lot of about Blackwater that we don't know yet. What really struck me is that even though Blackwater was the only private military firm which opened its doors to me, much of the interview I had with them was couched in this almost cowboy-like secrecy that they were very proud of being on these top secret missions. So I suspect that as the news starts to spread about this horrible event, we will start to learn more and more about Blackwater.
I want to thank you for being with us. Barry Yeoman wrote piece for Mother Jones on Blackwater USA and other private firms, looking at several pieces, among them a piece in Santiago written in March 5th, the U.S. hiring mercenaries in Chile to replace its soldiers on security duty in Iraq. A Pentagon contractor began recruiting former commandos, other soldiers and seamen, paying them up to $4,000 a month to guard oil wells against attack by insurgents. Talking about Blackwater USA. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Sharif Abdelkaddous, Mike Burke, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.